Hey everyone, it's Andrew and Craig, your favorite book guys from Overdue, the book podcast. This week we are reading a story called A Dangerously Sexy Christmas by Stephanie London. And it's very sexy and very dangerous.
Uh-huh.
So we're probably going to cuss is what we're saying.
And the book is a sexy book, so there's discussion of sex in a very frank,
yeah, there is.
Sexy way. So if if you're in mixed company or maybe want to like wait until you've had the necessary talks before folks hear about sexy books.
And if you need us to have the talk with anybody, just, you know, we can probably work something out.
Yeah, we'll find a Patreon tier for that later.
Great. All right, everybody, we'll see you in there.
Ho, ho, ho. Wait, what were you going to say?
I know I was going to say chestnuts roasting on open fire, but I like, what was your thing?
Ho, ho, ho. Horny holidays, everyone.
Horny holidays.
Welcome to Overdue, a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name's Andrew.
And we are horny for the holidays here on Overdue.
We are so horny for the holidays.
Hopefully everyone's been having a good season, celebrating in the ways that you will. With your wassail and your yules. And
we just hope that you're all ready to roast some nuts over open fire, because this is our second every 2 years. No, it's not a thing, but this is not the first triple Xmas that we've had on the show before.
That's true.
A couple years ago, we read Stealing Christmas, which was a book about a woman
named Christmas.
Named Christmas, who worked in a mall. Who had sex with the mall's owner.
Yeah.
Like unprotected really early and then got pregnant and then, but it was happily ever after.
Yes.
This book is, what did we read this week?
We both read it. A Dangerously Sexy Christmas by Stephanie London. And it is about, we'll get more into the plot a little later. It is about a jewelry designer and her bodyguard. And it had a bit.
And guarding is not all that he does with her body.
So we are going to have a good time this week, I hope, just to kind of mix it up for y'all in the holiday season, give you a little change of pace. We picked this one off of a couple of different lists of what's out there to read if you're looking for some Zadim.
I will give you here's my process when it comes time to look for a new sexy Christmas book for the show.
Yeah.
Is I Google sexy Christmas book and I then end up inevitably looking at a bunch of like Goodreads review pages and just trying to track down the ones that people seem to like. Cause I'm here for two things, and it can be in the same book. It can be either or. I'm either here for goofy over the top, like Stealing Christmas was, or I'm just up for something that is doing a better job than, say, the 50 Shades series.
True.
With respect to like interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
And balancing sex with anything else.
Now, this book is in a run of books by Stephanie London that I believe are referred to as the Dangerous Bachelor's Club series. It is Dangerously Sexy Christmas, A Dangerously Sexy Affair, A Dangerously Sexy Secret, and Mr. Dangerously Sexy, which is an amazing title.
I read the descriptions for a bunch of those books, and they all seem to be about someone who works in the like security industry somebody who they are guarding or like working with.
Interesting.
And the sparks end up flying.
Okay.
Because of all the friction.
Well, duh.
That their bodies generate when they smash them together.
So, like the Large Hadron Collider. So, this book was published in November 2015 by Stephanie London. London, I believe, is a pseudonym. I don't know what her non-nom de plume is. She was born
nom de regular.
She was born in Australia and now lives in Toronto. The Australia thing will come up in this book a couple of times. She's been a finalist
but in kind of weird ways,
yeah,
actually,
no, I'm
that
excited.
We'll talk about.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's been a finalist for multiple romance writer awards, including the short sexy category from the Romance Writers of Australia. Her most recent title, I think, according to her website, is Beauty and the Greek Billionaire, which I think is just, there's something about that title that tickles me.
Beauty and the Greek
Billionaire. It's like a pun and a half.
It's almost wordplay,
something.
But like not quite.
I'm into it. She went to college for like business and then worked in not writing for a long time before getting a publishing deal with Harlequin under their like Harlequin and Mills or Harlequin. These books are Harlequin Blaze.
So she says that she did not start like writing until 2012 when she did NaNoWriMo.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Which is, yeah, it's kind of a, it's a neat, I have never, by the time I think, oh, should I do it this year? It's always like November 5th. And
yes.
So I figure that I might be setting myself up to fail. And so I have a convenient excuse to not even try. But yeah, she did that in 2012. She started work on her, what she says is her very first manuscript. And then that went on to become her debut novel, Only the Brave Try Ballet. Mm. And she has written a whole bunch of stuff since then.
It's interesting that you mentioned NaNoWriMo because there was a part on her website that I thought was cool that like in her bio on her website, she dedicates a chunk of it to like, if you're reading this, wondering if you can do the thing that you've been putting off doing, maybe it's like writing a novel or whatever. She's like, here's what I did. And it's like, it's stuff that a lot of, you know, how to get into blank industry advice kind of gives you, but it's like, write your goal down, schedule time for it. Short-term goals are cool. Find other people who are interested in it. Find a person you care about who will hold you accountable. You know, promise yourself that it's worth it, and then like don't doubt yourself too much just because it's not happening right away. And I was struck by her like saying, no, this is a part of me and this is a part of my story, is making sure that like other people know how to do that and feel supported doing that.
That's cool of her.
Yeah. Another part of her website mentions the romance promise, which I tried like finding other allusions to that phrase and just found a bunch of romance books with the word promise in the title.
Yeah, we can talk a little bit about like the formula of romance novels, and I think you have something about like the exact like structure of them that
sure,
we can talk
sure.
about in a little bit. But yeah, maybe she is just formalizing kind of an unspoken genre convention thing here.
Yeah,
I don't know.
She's promising that books will have a happy ever after or happy for now ending. And then she
that's the best we can hope for sometimes, I guess,
know.
Isn't it?
And then in her specific book, she promises that they will have an uplifting story. There will be witty banter. There will be consensual but steamy sex. Australia will be at least mentioned. And characters will face real life problems that like ground them. Which, you know.
Yeah, I think this is specific to her books. I don't think needing to mention Australia
is a thing that happens in every romance novel. Yes. I don't think she's speaking for all romance writers.
You were saying you looked elsewhere for a romance promise.
Oh, yes. No, I found these on her website. This is what she says will be in her books. Before we get into this book, Andrew, you wanted to talk about Harlequin. You did a little research on Harlequin.
Yeah, they're the publishers of this and many fine romance novels. They are a Toronto-based publisher of romance and women's fiction. And conveniently, fun fact, Craig, guess
what?
How many years old they are right
69.
Now.
69, nice.
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 So they were owned by Torstar until 2014. That's the same company that owns whatever the Toronto paper is.
The Toronto Star?
Yeah,
perhaps.
There you go. And they were bought in 2014 by News Corp and HarperCollins, and that's where they are now.
Okay.
What
else about them? Anything?
I have other stuff aside from News Corp. So they began life 69 years ago.
Nice.
As a paperback reprinting company, and they published a lot of different kinds of stories, but they were not, they struggled to stay afloat. Like they did okay, but they weren't doing great. Mary Bonnycastle, who's a wife of the co-founder and majority owner, Richard Bonnycastle, enjoyed reading romance novels by this British publisher named Mills and Boone.
Okay.
And got the rights to republish Mills and Boone books in North America.
Sure.
And these were, like, a lot of them were medical romances, which is a specific kind of romance novel that, like, okay, takes advantage of the fact that there are a lot of patients, and so they're just, like, a lot of bodies around.
Oh, well, and also, like, Mills and Boone, as I recall, is over 100 years old, so I imagine when they were, like, getting into, you know, really picking up post-war speed, there was, like, you know, the imbalance of who doctors are and whatnot. So it's a, sure, that's a situation ripe for a man and a woman to
but
get,
yeah,
together.
it was before, you know, the global market was as much of a thing, and so they was they bought the rights to different Mills and Boone novels, and because, like, Mary Bonnycastle wanted to adapt them to make them a little less steamy sexy, so they bought the rights to books, and then they repackaged them, and then they republished them in North America with a lot of the, like, sexier stuff taken out. But Harlequin's site lays out the basic format that you can still recognize in most romance stories today, including but not limited to Hallmark Channel movies.
Oh,
about,
sure,
Christmas. The plot often involved a chance meeting in an interesting setting, a courtship that allowed both parties to overcome personal obstacles, and a happy denouement almost inevitably involving marriage.
Mm, okay.
So by 1964, Harlequin was a company that was exclusively dedicated to republishing these Mills and Boone romance novels. And by 75, Harlequin bought and owned Mills and Boone outright.
Okay. Okay.
Mills and Boone continues to exist as its own, like, separate entity to this day, but Harlequin is the parent company.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, one of the many kind of pioneering things that Harlequin did, aside from, man, there are just so many markets where if you go back to the 40s or 50s, like, what you do to pioneer is just, like, acknowledge that women exist,
yep,
as consumers who would like to buy goods.
Weird, huh?
Yeah. So they pioneered sales by selling stuff to women, like, where they were at the time, which was mostly in, like, supermarkets and other places. And they did not at the time, like, traditionally sell books, but if you go into a supermarket or, like, a Walmart or a Target or something today and look at their book selection, you're still going to find, I think, that it is heavily weighted in favor of these sort of potboiler romance,
yep, 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 yep,
novels. And like I mentioned, Harlequin and Bonnycastle early on were reluctant to publish sexier books. That's a thing that, you know, that's a wall that came down gradually as time went on.
90s were a weird time.
Yeah, it created an opening for other romance publishers like Simon & Schuster and Dell Publishing to get into the market. And one fun fact was that Dell Publishing was the first to publish books with non-virginal heroines.
Dude, you're getting a Dell.
I know, right? Well, it's not like Dell Computer, it's Dell Publishing.
I know.
But that happened happening in, like, the 80s.
Okay. That's kind of neat, actually.
And then so Simon & Schuster's imprint for romance was called Silhouette Books, which Harlequin later bought. So I think they still are sort of the dominant force in this market, but it's just kind of neat to read up about the history and how it was. You know, it was some publisher guy's wife who came in and was like, what if women?
Yeah, right.
What if books, but for women?
There was some of that going on when we were talking about the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, too, of just like,
what if books, but for children?
Yeah, like, what if stuff, but for other than old men?
What if books weren't just old white men writing books for and about each other to each other?
Well, yeah, huh. What could the world be?
You're just thinking about that one.
Yeah, I was just sitting and thinking about that one. I also like the idea of old white men writing books explicitly for each other. Like, here I wrote you this book. Here I wrote you this 1,200-page inscrutable novel, Fred.
About whales, and it's just for you.
Yep, it's just for you. You want to talk about this book, though, I guess?
Let's talk about this very sexy book.
So, the book is dangerous and it is sexy, but often not at the same time.
Well, and you should also note that it is taking place near Christmas.
It is very... Of the three things in its title, Well, the four things. It is a book. So that, yeah, okay, great.
It is a book, so pass.
Great. It's pretty dangerous. Characters are threatened with harm.
Knives.
Knives appear. I don't think anybody gets shot, but it, you know, who knows? No. Sex happens. And it is near Christmas.
Of the of the four words in the title, it is the least amount Christmas.
Which is a
shame. Like, I think in order, it's a book, first and foremost. It's sexy, second, I think. And then dangerous. And then Christmas.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. I have some thoughts on, like, thematically why it still fits in, like, a Christmas mold. But we should probably talk about what the book is actually.
Let's do it.
So our two main characters, and we spend the book going between their points of view as London needs to have happen. Max Ridgway, an Australian security officer who is now, well, he was a cop in Australia, and now he is a, like, private security man
in New York.
New York City, the Big Apple. He has been assigned to Rose Lawson, a young, I don't remember how old she is, if she's 30 or,
so she never says. She makes a point of saying that Max is 33 and that he knows how old Rose is, but we don't get to know. So I assume that means that Rose can be, she's young, but I think, like, anywhere between, like, 25 and 35 makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. She's younger than him, it reads like, but unclear.
And you should know that, like many romance novel heroines, she is slim but shapely. Which I just... Do you gotta do that every time? Like, everyone who writes about women's bodies, when you're trying to make them sound alluring, do you need to make sure that, oh yeah, they're shapely, they're feminine, but no fatties?
Yeah. Maybe it's an aspirational thing. I don't know.
I guess, I don't.
Even that's kind of weird.
That was one of the things about Stealing Christmas that I actually kind of liked. Was,
oh sure, yeah.
That's like, yeah, she's good to go, and she is just regular shapely. She's not slim.
Well, Max Ridgway is meeting Rose Lawson, who is this jewelry designer, part time jewelry store employee, who has moved back to America from London. After her mother's passing, and she has, there were break-ins at her jewelry store, which she doesn't own it, but at the jewelry store where she works, and so her dad, who she hasn't spoken to in 11 years, assigned her a private security detail, and it opens sort of like a noir movie where, like, they're in Max's office, and it's unclear how much he is a detective and how much he's a rent-a-cop. Like, it's kind of... I don't really know.
He's a detective. I don't think we have to make the distinction.
That's a good point. He does, like,
a PI, kind of, but with a big, burly body and a bunch of leather jackets and jeans.
Yes, that's true. And he is, like, dealing with her, trying to explain the situation. And as we get some descriptions of Rose, and then the whole sexy package probably turned other men to goo, but her appearance, while thoroughly enjoyable, would not distract him, is what Max resolves. But she does talk to him, and a shot of heat is sent through him, so he can't, he's already knowing that something's gonna,
From very early on, there's a lot of sexual chemistry. Unless we think that this is one-sided.
Nope.
Chapter two begins with, like, from we get Rose's perspective for the first time, and it's like, dang. As if it wasn't bad enough to have her place of work and her house broken into, now she had to reveal the sorry state of her personal life to Mr. G.I. Joe wannabe, the super hot, muscled beyond belief G.I. Joe wannabe. She calls him G.I. Joe wannabe a bunch of times, even though he's from Australia.
She does that to him as an insult early, and Max's response in his head is, ouch, the lady had an acid tongue.
Ouch.
Okay. So we get this. We get some, like, little drips and drabs of, like, why he left. We know he left a life behind because something went wrong. We don't really know what Rose's family's deal is, except that she doesn't like her dad.
Her dad and her mom split up. Her mom is dead, and she doesn't have a relationship really with her dad.
Yes, and so. Things are dangerous for her, so he's going to walk her. He's going to take her to her house.
And he's going to make things sexy.
Well, that's not his explicit plan.
Yeah, right, but it does become explicit later.
That's true. That's true. They go to her house, and as you said, Andrew, he notices it with his spidey senses, which has earned him the nickname Spider-Man.
Can you do that?
Fair use. He notices like a cigarette butt outside of her front door, and he's like, "Do you smoke?" And she's like, "Nah." And they open the door, and someone is in the process of ransacking her house for something they do not know. The man escapes, and so he's like, "Okay, we got to go stay at a hotel." And this is where things get
this
sexy.
Is where things start to get a little sexy after the first part, which is mostly dangerous.
Yeah, it's a really like lean into the something. There were dangerous people here looking for something. Rose doesn't seem to know what they're looking for. And at this point in the novel, I could not tell if Rose was being earnest. Like, the perspective shifts kept happening just before she would, like, tell the reader whether or not she knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
At least for, like, the first half of the book.
Sure.
And so I was like, okay, that's useful. Like, the perspective shifts are keeping us from getting too far into either character's head so that they can keep, like, not knowing each other very well.
Yeah.
But then it's time for sex in the hotel, Andrew.
It's time for sex in the hotel. And they are both, like, I don't know, they both got walls up emotionally speaking.
Yes.
But they both also want to slam each other.
He is sleeping on the couch, I think, like outside the door of her suite.
Mm-hmm. And they both have condoms.
They both have condoms.
They each have a condom, just in case.
She has a moment where she is like lying in the bed and thinking like, man, maybe these guys are going to kill me. I don't want to die alone. Actually, I don't want to die without more sex. And like,
well, she just wants sex, which
yes.
is cool. But she decides she wants it. She slips into the hotel bathrobe, puts her emergency condom in the robe's pocket. And I do actually think that the fact that they both have a condom on them is interesting because it does back up the consent part of it. Like, they mm-hmm. were both ready to do this.
Yes, correct. And the book is pretty clear that she is initiating the whole thing.
And so, okay, so she's initiating the whole thing. The thing that the book does, I think, to make sure that the reader knows that Max is a very good guy is that he manually stimulates her
right
until
away.
She orgasms. Like, yes. Right away, the first time. Instead of just doing that thing that, like, all, like, popular books and TV shows do, where, like, all women can orgasm from just,
yeah,
like, penetration.
Yes. Yes.
So yeah, he does that, and then they have sex. Like, he takes care of her first, which is great, and then later he goes down on her without asking or being asked.
Yeah, he's a,
which
he's
is another like sort of fantasy aspect of
yeah.
the novel.
So of the two of them, she is the one who has like who thinks love doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's not for me. My parents' marriage didn't work out, so I don't get to be loved. But sex is good; it makes me feel good. I should be able to get it when I want it. And I'm going to. And like that's
and, she does.
And that's her approach to their like relationship. And she, you know, falls herself. She starts feeling things for him, which is problematic. He was engaged in Australia. And later in the book, you find out like a tragedy happened with his partner who was a cop. And his partner was related to his fiance. And so he had to run away because things were so bad. But he is like a serial monogamist. So he is,
right.
He treats people right, it seems like, as you just said.
He doesn't, it takes time for him to let people in, but once they're in, like, they're in there.
Yeah. So they're both, like, operating from a kind of, some shaky ground emotionally as they meet each other. And they both feel pretty alone. They're both isolated. And this has all been a very nice, serious conversation about these characters, Andrew, but I do need to point out that when they start having sex, she just starts taking off his pants, his jeans, and he is not wearing underpants. He is a private detective
oh, wow.
who's just going around commando. What?
I know later that he has boxers that don't hide anything.
No, yes. This first time, though.
But the first time.
He walked into her house and a criminal knocked him over. And he said nothing about the fact that he was not wearing underwear in jeans.
Are you sure that he wasn't wearing underwear at that time? Like, I know he wasn't wearing them in the hotel, but he did have chances to...
I don't think he changed his clothes.
I would like jeans. Obviously, are the least comfortable clothing to do that with. If you're going to do that,
his excuse is that it was laundry day. Yeah, his excuse is that it was laundry day. Which, oh, dude, I don't know.
That doesn't. No, that doesn't check out.
I don't think so. but they have fun. Their sex is fun. She shatters at one point, which was a pretty metal verb for when she orgasms.
She does shatter. Do you want to like? Do you just want to talk about sex words?
Oh, in we this could one? Talk about.
You said
sex
you didn't
words.
Have that many. Like, this book actually does a pretty good job at not repeating itself over and over.
Sure.
It kind of helps that there are only a few sex scenes throughout.
Three or four, like, big ones.
Yeah, and that's something I also kind of wanted to talk about is I think this book actually does, like, a pretty good job balancing sex stuff and plot stuff, though it is more sex heavy in the first half and more plot heavy in the second half, I would say. But when they were having sex, I was like, yeah, this is fine.
Yeah.
But, like, when are we going to find out more about the diamonds? You know?
So
I was interested in knowing more where like stealing Christmas is like, I guess like you own a mall that you might want to sell, but maybe you don't like I didn't care about that.
Yeah. Well,
it was just
also,
like, when is he going to nut? You know,
the sex was less.
And this is like
this sex.
Yeah.
Was less
I'm glad that you're both going to do it. But I want, you know, I also want to know about the diamonds.
Yes. This sex was like fun and good, but it wasn't as cartoonish as the stealing Christmas. Like. Ropes in the shower.
The ropes.
Stuff.
Yeah, the infamous memorable. Gosh. Yikes.
But yeah, was there anything that struck you about like any of the scenes that you want to? We can kind of
hit plot as we bounce from sex to sex
as necessary.
I don't love the use, and I think we've talked about this before. I don't love the use of sex as a noun.
Okay.
It happens for both of them, for her more than for him, but they both get. A penis and a vagina referred to as his or her sex
sure.
at least a few times each. And then also London describes her as slick.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when she's aroused mm-hmm. and ready to have sex, mm-hmm. she's slick. Her whole situation is slick. And yeah. Slick
is that
like
just not a word that you enjoy for this.
Slick is like, I'm playing Mario Kart and I run over a banana peel. Like it's not, sex word for me.
Okay.
You know,
the one that I thought was a little silly was I think this is like maybe the second or third time that they are having sex and she asks him to put his fingers inside her and uh-huh. it jumps perspective and it says the words set fire to his soul. The need to please her consumed him like an Australian bushfire, roaring until his fears were burned to ashes. And I think the book's weakness is in its similes, and it's not just in the sex scenes. I think it's actually like pretty good at just describing what, you know, sex and what they're making each other feel. But when it uses a simile, so like this is a non-sex simile that struck me weird. New York driving was something else. If it wasn't for the fact that his job often required him to travel all over the state, he wouldn't have bothered with a car. Driving in New York was kind of like trying to befriend a criminal. Pointless and risky. What?
Like, yeah, there were... now that you mention it, like I liked some of them,
okay.
But the way that simile is deployed in this book, yeah, is like you always kind of notice them.
Yes.
Which can be good or bad.
Yeah, they really like land. There's not a flow to them. to no pun intended.
Rose rolled the idea around in her head. Having Max at such close proximity might be a good thing. Last night hadn't taken the edge off. In fact, sleeping with him had only stoked the fires that had lain dormant since her mother died last year. He was like the first bite of chocolate after a year-long sugar deprivation. Sinfully delicious, and she wanted more.
Okay.
Like, that's not ineffective, but it is... It's not a... thing.
Yeah, well, and also let me point out something in that passage that's interesting. I think I remember that one too. Listeners of the show may know our friends Christina and Camille over the Unfriendly Black Hotties. They did a holiday smut spectacular episode recently and they talked about how some of the best sex writing like includes emotional stuff or alludes to it when necessary so that some of it is like character driven. And so there's that note about her mom there in that passage you just read, which like might be a bit of an ear pull, like it might kind of distract you a little bit. But even if it didn't, even if it was working, the chocolate thing just undermines it entirely.
The chocolate thing. So yeah, there are two issues. Like one is, why is your horniness connected to your mom so much?
Yes.
Like these things, like I understand what she's trying to say, which is that loss can make people less interested in a lot of stuff. But what it sounds like is like, oh man, my mom died. It's a real boner killer.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like,
and so like contrast that with some stuff that I think works okay, which is so like later after they've been having sex for a little bit. They have another check-in about like condoms and she goes, no, I'm on the pill and I had a physical, so I'm clean. And he goes, yep, I have physicals for work, which is like just a little interesting, like, boonk, just make sure that that's all cool. And then she says she grasped it in her hands and positioned him at her entrance. Time seemed to suspend itself before she sank down and pushed him inside. Like, it's
pushed him deep inside.
Push him deep inside.
Because I had the thing where they quickly confirmed that it was cool for them to have unprotected sex.
Yes.
Highlighted as well.
Yes. And then from
because
there,
I could see like if you're reading this and you are like trying to have fun.
Yeah.
But also you don't want people to do stuff that seems too like bad and unsafe in real life. Like,
yes,
this little exchange is very, it happens in a flash. It's very utilitarian and then they get onto the thing. But yeah, it is definitely there and I definitely like highlighted it and made note of it.
Yeah. And then it's pretty at that. The rest of this passage doesn't have those kind of like attention grabbing similes. Like towards the end, it's she rubbed herself against him, the angle of her hips causing pleasure to shoot through him and his control slipped. He wanted this to last forever, but his orgasm rushed up, fueled by the tremors deep inside Rose as he thrust into her. It's just like, this is how they feel. This is what they're doing. They feel great. They love each other. Like, they love having sex with each other. What do you want? Whereas like, The other similes can kind of really be clunkers, unfortunately.
I also didn't. So one in Stephanie London's Romance Promise.
Yeah.
She talks about how part of her promise is that every book will involve Australia in some way. Uh-huh. And so that simile you highlighted earlier where like whatever it was
the Australian
like an Australian brush fire, which I feel like a brush fire anywhere
is bad
burns
news.
Kind of the same way. Like, there's nothing specific about Australian brush fires that I'm aware of. But yeah, I feel like it's kind of, it doesn't matter that much in this book, except insofar as he, like, home for him is a faraway place. And so eventually they both have a choice to make, which we'll talk about. Like, we'll get back to the plot in a second.
Yeah.
But so there was that brush fire thing. They just mention his accent all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the morning after they do the unprotected sex thing. She'd taken another hit of a very addictive substance and it would only be a downward slide from here. Surely there was a 12-step program for hot Australian men.
Okay.
Surely.
Surely.
Like, he's from Australia though.
Crikey, there must
like,
be
this
a plan.
This is how you know he's from Australia.
Yeah, I guess it's just like, I don't know. When I was looking back on the book and thinking about her weaving this in there as a character trait, it doesn't actually, maybe there's stuff I just missed. Maybe it's just like so subtle.
Maybe I'm just uninformed about Australian brush fires.
That's
like,
true.
Maybe they are really different.
Yes. We alluded to a diamond caper, which we should get back to. So
we should get back to the diamond caper.
So
why don't you hit it?
Their second time having sex, it follows a Q&A striptease that she uses to learn about him, which is kind of a fun scene. It's kind of neat.
And it's it's a weird combination of foreplay and corporate retreat icebreaker activity.
Yeah, it's kind of good. And they have some sex in the kitchen, and then they're moving to the bathtub to have more sex. And someone leaves her a voicemail on her machine that says, "We know you have the Noel diamond. You won't be able to run away to London this time." Now, keep in mind that she was taken to London by her now past mom to London over a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
So these dudes have just been sitting, waiting on this diamond for 10
years. They've been waiting on the diamond. And so they have no leads at this point. And so the fact that the threatening men are calling and leaving very like context heavy voicemail messages is helpful for the investigation at this point.
Yes, that's true. So she, of course, knows nothing about what they're talking about. He goes into his office and is like, "Hey, lady at my office, can you Google this thing for me?" Like, we meet this character, Quinn. It's implied that she loves computers. She's like a Donatello-esque figure, I suppose. And is like, she does machines.
I understand what you're doing.
And she is like, okay, I'll look it up for you. I'll Google it for you. And it turns out that it's this like fancy diamond that was found in a mine in Arkansas or something. And some,
are you sure it was Arkansas?
It was either Arkansas or Alabama. Like, I'm not
famous
lying.
Arkansas diamonds.
And either like some Italian mafioso had it, and somebody wants it back. Somebody's trying to get it back. And the evidence is mounting, what little evidence there is, that perhaps there's a connection to Rose's dad. And Max is obviously keeping this from Rose. Because, again, she's not his client.
Her dad is... Okay, so her dad is the client, and her dad has also made, like, overtures wanting to reestablish a relationship. So her dad, like, came over to her apartment and gave her some kind of present, and
yep.
And Rose was very touched by this and is like, well, you know, I don't know if... I was only a kid when they split up. I'm not aware of the full thing. Like, maybe I can have a family relationship, maybe I can have a relationship with my dad. Wouldn't it be nice?
Yeah, because she has no other family. Her two aunts are scattered across the world, like
her
in Ohio and New Zealand.
Her best friend is some woman from a coffee shop.
Yep, that she'd like just met.
I was very suspicious of for a long time, but who doesn't actually end up being much of a factor in
the
story at all.
Why I was suspicious of her? Because Rose's crack security system that she has an app for was recommended to her by the coffee shop lady, and she tells, like, she's like, "Oh, I have an app. The lady at the coffee shop told me to get it. It's a good security system.
It's a good security app."
Because someone has
it turns
been...
out she's just recommending apps like yes. any friend might.
She's an influencer. That becomes important because someone has been using the code to get in. The code is Rose's mom's birthday. So maybe someone who knows that information is using it to get into the house. And so their relationship also is like, it's becoming more solid. They're having sex more frequently. They have
yeah,
a
they
thing
are.
Going on.
Yeah, it's very solid.
And he is not sure if he should like allow this to move forward from his side. She's doubting that it could be real and just fighting her own doubts about it. He gets a call from his old cop boss in Australia who's like, "Listen, we know you needed some time away. Why don't you reapply and we'll hire you as soon as you're ready?" And so he's like, "As soon as I'm done with this case, I'm going to move back to Australia so we can't be in a relationship." And so he's, you know, he doesn't want to hurt her, but he does want to have sex with her. It's a very difficult quandary.
Well, because he initially thought it would be a one-night stand thing, but now he's developing feelings for her, but they both have their things. Like, she is nervous about opening up to anybody, and he is, one, like you said, not used to doing like one night stands, not used to doing non-long-term things, but also very much wants to, now that he is processed, I don't think we've actually talked about the dark secret of his past yet.
I alluded now to that it, but we should talk about it. Yeah.
Now that he's processed this trauma that's happened to him, he actually is very interested in getting home and like picking up the pieces and moving on.
Yeah.
But can he do that? Can he go back to Australia and do that while he is like working on feelings for her?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, he like trusted his instincts, or he followed the rules instead of trusting his instincts, and it caused his partner to run into a meth house alone and get killed. And she like gets him to open up about it after one of their nights together. And then she's particularly hurt when he does not spend the night in her bed because he's trying to create distance. And then this, of course, leads them to have a fight. She leaves the house basically without his permission because he's supposed to be keeping an eye on her at all times. And she gets jumped in the street by the same dude who was in her house. This is when Max is running down the street to try and catch her. And a kid on the sidewalk yells, "Run, Forrest, run," at him. And it's the funniest thing.
It is funny, but what year is it?
I don't know, man.
What year? Like, I know that in the late 90s, if you ran anywhere in a middle or high school, that somebody would yell, "Run, Forrest, run," at you.
It's so good.
Especially if they didn't like you or were trying to like make fun of you or imply something about you.
I don't know, man. I thought it was a pretty
sick reference.
Like,
what kid in, like, assuming it happens in 2015 or at really any time in the 10 years before 2015, what kid is going to be yelling this thing from a movie from before it was born?
I don't know. It's pretty good.
You just say that because you like Forrest Gump.
I do love Forrest Gump. It's a weakness of mine. But so again, we don't know who's hiring these dudes. Max, he kind of observes that they were not trying to harm her. They were like using like
infers is right.
Yeah. They were using like rusty knives. They were like,
he just thinks, yeah, they didn't have guns, and the knife they were using seems bad. It seems like a bad knife.
Yeah. So again,
like a bad knife can't still hurt somebody.
The dad is now a suspect. He does a little more Googling or whatever to find out that the dad had a big gambling problem and was like having an affair with this mafia boss's daughter.
Right.
Somehow that meant that he got the diamond and that somehow Rose's mom got the diamond. It's really
like the diamond definitely, it wasn't stolen, like it definitely belongs to them, but I did have a little bit of trouble like tracing the provenance of this diamond, because it's important that they have the diamond, but it's not super important how they got it,
and it's
in the first place
also unclear who exactly needs it back from her. Like, are there mob guys coming?
Well, no, it's her dad needs it back from her
to pay off
his gambling debts.
Okay.
Yeah,
the book is not great about that. Cause,
well, I got it, so maybe you just weren't great about it.
Maybe I was distracted by the sex.
You were distracted with typical.
I was distracted by the scene where she blindfolds him and then like runs ice cubes all over his body. Cause I've never done that, and I can't tell if I would hate it or if I would like it a lot.
It did make me like curious.
I was kind of curious about it.
Like contrasts.
I guess maybe what I wouldn't want is just to have the like melted ice on me.
Like, you just don't want like room temperature water on you eventually.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But I'm also like, ooh, just like ice cube touches you, you don't know where it's coming from. Ooh.
Yeah, it's cold, but I mean, you know where it's coming from though.
But he was blindfolded.
Yeah, but he still knew that it was Rose doing it.
Yes. Oh, it's not like a sneak attack. Like,
no,
a
it's
burglar.
Not like somebody just like puts like when someone puts a snowball down your shirt or something like that sucks. But no, this is just like, where's it coming from?
Ooh.
How's it going to go?
Yes. It goes great in this book. That's how it is. So then the mystery then just like takes over the book after the ice cube sex. I think that's the last sex they have in the book. Because then it's like, okay, your dad is in on it. Let me break your heart about it.
Yeah, she shuts down after he finally tells her that her dad is probably responsible because she had just started opening herself back up to her dad. And
they find the diamond in a music box.
They find the diamond in a music box, and then the case is closed
very quickly.
And Max is like, "Well, I'm going back to Australia, but I'll stay here for you." And she says, "Well, I saw my parents grow to resent the sacrifices they made for each other, and I wouldn't want that to happen to us."
Yes.
And so she doesn't go, and that says something that I don't love about what it means when someone sacrifices something for you.
Yeah, okay.
But that's not something we need to talk about right now, I don't guess. So he leaves, he goes to Australia, and she is kind of bumming around. It's almost Christmas. She doesn't like Christmas because that's the time of year when her parents separated.
Mm-hmm. And her mom always flight to London, yeah.
Yeah, and her mom always wanted to put up a Christmas tree, but she hated it, and they always fought about it. And so this is the first Christmas since her mom died, but she put up a tree anyway. And it says that she wants to love Christmas again. Christmas is only very tangentially involved.
Yeah, there are some Christmas decorations in the coffee shop. She's got Christmas.
But none of the like sex involves Christmas.
No, none of the sex involves Christmas.
What kind of Christmas sex would you like? You tie him up with Christmas lights.
Uh-huh. Dangerous. That's dangerous. Also dangerous.
Very dangerous. If they're the incandescent ones, they can get pretty hot.
I don't think that you should do anything with pine needles because sap sucks. Like sap is real bad.
And if you have a cat, they can eat the pine needles and it will puncture their little intestines.
Yes.
Which is why we can't have a real tree in our house.
I think you need to have a lot of like wrapping paper and bows.
Wrapping paper and bows. Like you wrap up your like butt.
Yeah, that's
as a present, and you're like, uh-huh. Here, Merry Christmas, I got you my butt.
Yep, you light some like candles that smell like pine needles or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's sexy, right?
You just kind of make like a gingerbread dildo or something.
Yeah, you could do that.
Yeah.
Is there anything sexy? There's nothing sexy about a gingerbread house.
In more ways than one. No, I don't think so.
Unless you like put your junk in the house and then said like check out what's inside the house.
Oh, like a dick in a box.
Yeah,
but with the gingerbread.
But a nice warm gingerbread house.
And you could like eat your way to the
That's
dick.
Good. That's
yeah.
good.
There you go. Okay, we got there.
We solved it. I'm glad that we solved it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not enough Christmas.
Not enough Christmas.
So what there is to me in this about a Christmas book. About Christmas in the book is that like the reconnecting to family and like the emotional work being done there and like what Rose is up to in terms of like, oh, I'm trying to reconnect with my dad. I'm not sure if he's a criminal. My mom died a year ago. I don't really have anyone at this time of year. That stuff feels like extreme versions of what a lot of people go through during the holidays of like it's because it's this like this month December is like a month of like be with your family and like celebrate what you have, and
the season runs on like having access to your emotions. I guess I was gonna say emotionally manipulative. I don't think that's necessarily true, but every like it is a very commercial season, and every one of those commercials is like, you know, be with your family, be with your loved ones, be with whatever. And I forget the second part of the point that I was making.
Well,
I don't know what we were talking
if
about.
If that's difficult but, for you,
oh,
or
yes,
you
right,
don't have
right.
ready it's, access to it.
Well, and if anything bad happens to your family in that season, like I know people who have like lost somebody during the holiday season. And so every holiday season from then on, like to a greater extent even than like a regular anniversary or other occasions, yep. is tinged with this thing
yep.
that nobody can stop thinking about. And so, yeah, especially if you have some kind of emotional trauma happen to you during the holidays, it's like, hey, how about what if all of society conspired to trigger whatever sensations it is that would like recreate these thoughts and like these situations for you for the rest of time forever.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't even notice or care, or like there's nobody you could talk to make it stop. You can't go to Macy's and be like, stop it. Take the decorations down. My dad died. I hate it.
Yeah. You can't do that. There's too much money to be made. The Coca-Cola company won't put away their polar bears for you.
They won't. Not for you, not for anybody.
And so the book, like, it doesn't...
All the polar bears could actually die, and Coca-Cola would not bat an eye about it.
They'd keep trotting them out. There's penguins now, too. The book tackles some of this stuff, like, mostly obliquely. Like, it's mostly in the background. We know that this stuff is in Rose... and in her character, but we only get like tiny moments of it. There's not like a long scene about her dealing with Christmas or anything like that. Until like the end, when she does fly there to be with him, and he's like, "Oh, so you're gonna? I noticed that you flew on Christmas Eve. You're open to replacing bad memories with good memories or something."
Sure.
And that's kind of, they're both acknowledging that they're going to do the work, and it's, you know, we'll see what happens. She's going to be fine selling jewelry in Australia, I suppose.
Yeah, she says, like, oh, the internet.
Yeah, she's like, I'll have a blog. The internet makes it,
because earlier she'd said, you know, I'm in New York, and this is the place where I can get the most exposure for my jewelry business. But yes. Listen, man, like, Etsy exists everywhere, as far as I know.
Yeah, so...
There's
before I get into this Anatomy of a Romance novel article by Catherine Roach that I want to share with you.
We've talked about anatomy like quite a bit already.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. I do want to point out that I kind of like the entrepreneurial spirit of Rose is neat. Like she moves somewhere and then like works at the store, but then is also like working on her side hustle throughout the book. And the couple scenes we get about it are, I thought, like, pretty smart about, hey, I'm going to try and build this client a thing so that she will then recommend me to other people. And it just feels like that just feels real. That just feels like written from the perspective of someone who has hustled and like sold a manuscript. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like that while Max Ridgway is this G.I. Joe wannabe man, and he is apparently supposed to be a very good cop, he's not like the best most cop. Like he's good at his job, but he's not a superhero. He's not, when you meet him again in Australia and he's gone back on the force, he's not like instantly in charge. Like maybe he got a promotion, but he's not like the chief of police or anything. He's just like there to do his job. I kind of appreciated that they were both just like people who had a calling, but they weren't like the jewelry designer and the cop of this universe, if that makes sense. So Andrew, I want to hit you with some elements of a romance novel. This was published on signaturereads.com. And I want you to tell me what you think about how this book relates to them.
Okay.
So number one, it's hard to be alone.
Okay.
Like,
it's true.
For these characters, I think, right? Like they're both like isolated and solo.
They are both alone, and they're both kind of bummed about it, because for Max, it is in contrast to the life he had before where he had this best friend and he was dating her sister and they were going to become brothers, and then he dies and it ruins everything. For her, it's a longer simmering thing where she's in a new place. She has no friends. She has no family. Like it just sucks.
Yes. It's a man's world.
It is.
Yeah, I put mostly.
Like insofar as her father is the bad guy and her father hired Max, yes. But she is doing it for herself with her jewelry business.
Mm-hmm.
And she does initiate the first sexual encounter, if not most of the sexual encounters.
Yes. I think it's also like the illicit affair by her dad sets the events of the book in motion, even from like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's that element too, but yeah, it's not like the whole part of the thing.
Like she is doing very well for herself in terms of like being an independent character who wants and can get things independently. But yes, her misery is engineered primarily yes. by men. So there you go.
The next two, romance is a religion of love and romance requires hard work. I think the hard work
There's some hard work.
The religion of love thing, like, there's a lot more, like, doubting of connection in this book. So I don't know that that's... Neither character spends the most of the book trying to get into a long-term loving relationship. They're actually
They spend most of the book wrestling with their feelings about how they relate to other people and what they want. Like, okay. There is work that's happening, for
that's
sure.
That's true. Romance involves risk, which I noted. I think she literally says love takes risk at one point. So,
that would make sense.
Yes. Romance facilitates healing.
Yes.
Yes.
Because at the end of the book, they both are close, if not where they want to be, then closer to where they want to be.
Yes. I also made a specific note of when he tells her story about his partner dying, and she's like, yeah, but like, have you really thought about it? And he's just like, oh, yeah, I guess you're
I right. guess I haven't. I guess, like, I have been avoiding this whole time.
She heals him, like, instantly.
So he says the exact word that London uses is, she says that something in him shifts when they have this conversation. Like, she explicitly says, oh, it's not fixed forever.
Or completely, yeah.
She has made me think about this in a way that I clearly haven't been thinking about it. And it's in a way that is going to help me, if not get over it, then at least, like, live with it and not be defined by it. Yeah.
Romance leads to great sex, especially for women. Yep.
Yeah.
At one point, like, London's like, yeah, he just grabbed her G-spot and went for it. Like,
yeah, he is very attentive to her needs in a way that I think is good. It's good.
They're usually going at it for a couple rounds at a time, too.
You know how when we talked at the beginning of the show about, like, what if books but for women?
Yeah.
Like, what if orgasms but for women?
I know, right?
You know?
Really makes you think.
Mm-hmm.
Romance makes you happy as a, like, truism in the book. I think that's true. They are both happier people for their romance.
Yeah.
We do see that guy, Owen.
Is romance make you happy? Is that supposed to be about the characters, or is that supposed to be about me and you as readers?
I think it's
readers?
Supposed to be about the characters and, like, what the worldview of the book is. Is that, like, maybe you need it to be happy, which can be a double-edged sword, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I do, you get that guy, Owen, who's Max's friend, who's just kind of like a lone wolf. He's just, like, not trying to settle down. He seems pretty well-adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's not exclusive in this book.
Well, I'm just saying, like, there are a lot of romance novels, or just, like, we got to a little bit of it with the promise thing that we talked about, but
yeah.
I think in the romance novels that we've read, a lot of them make a point of mentioning, like, yeah, we want to do a story that ends with happily ever after that, like, yeah. helps you get what you need from erotic fiction,
sure,
but also
sure.
ends with a couple characters having happily ever after. Well, so I feel like both character and reader happiness is important.
Yeah,
that
and
sense.
That's important too, because sex can be this very vulnerable thing between people, mm-hmm. and to have it work out is important, I think, for what, depending on the effect of your book. And then the last one is romance levels the playing field. It does in the bedroom in this book.
Yeah, it does.
They do, like, kind of fight over who's in charge, because he's got this, like, job-related reason to boss her around. And yet, like, she's like, I want to do things my way.
But he also, like, he also surrenders that power to her. Like, there's
he does.
A
yep.
point in the book where she is going down on him, and it says, she might have been the one on her knees, but she had total power in that moment. His hand stroked her head, fingers tangling in her hair. All of a sudden, the sound of his orgasm filled her ears. Her name, garbled with utter pleasure, was so loud it blocked everything else out as he shuddered against her. She stood and he grabbed her, crushing her to his chest, his face buried in her hair. He didn't say anything, not a single word, but she knew then what they had was more than sex.
Whoa.
Ooh.
They say each other's name a lot. There's a lot of names saying.
They do, and I think it's because otherwise you would forget what their names were.
That's probably true.
That's just my hypothesis.
So yeah, those are the, that's like the 9 parts of a romance novel from Catherine Roach that I thought was interesting, and interesting to compare this book to. She has like written some books on romance novels in addition to writing her own while also being a professor. So interesting points of comparison. Anything else you want to say about this? I wish there were more Christmas.
I wish there were more Christmas because we did read it for Christmas.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I appreciate what I was trying to do. I appreciate London's wider body of work.
Sure.
I don't know about the other books in the Dangerously Sexy Bachelors series or whatever it's called. But I think she knows what people want and what they need.
Yeah. I might need to go read Mr. Dangerously Sexy. Because I think it's a really good title.
Well, you just report back.
If I do.
So, we got you all this boner for Christmas.
Oh.
You're welcome, everybody. We hope this book gave you lots of fun. If you read it along with us, which we hope you did. You should.
If you have other recommendations for sexy Christmas novels, you should send them in to us at overduepod@gmail.com. Hit us up online at twitter.com/overduepod or facebook.com/overduepod. Thanks to folks reaching out in the last week or so. It's a little out of time when we're recording this, but thanks Rebecca, Steve, Allegra, Erica, Stacy, Marley, Ken, Alex, Rachel, Gloria, and many more. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where should they go?
They should go to overduepodcast.com, which is the internet website. Up there we have links to iTunes, Google Play, our RSS feed. You can use any of those to subscribe to the show. I think in Apple Podcasts, we are pushing...
I think we did it.
1,000.
Oh, did it go back?
Wait, what happened? Oh, no, yeah, we did it.
We did it.
Yeah, okay. So we just made it over. I got a weird 521 reading. Are you saying that? Seeing that?
Yeah, you want to make a note about this? It happened when I was looking at it on my phone earlier. I also saw someone else who runs a podcast in Philly saying that a bunch of their reviews went away and they're confused about it. So,
well, it looks like they're back in regular iTunes.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know what it is.
We just recently popped over 1,000 ratings in iTunes, which is a big deal. And we've gotten a lot of those this year. Woo! And it's just very nice to know that all of you have nice stuff to say about the show, or even like constructive criticism about the show, because we do take that to heart. We do pay attention to it. We get that in email too, and it is sometimes hard to read, but always helpful, I think. We also have up on overduepodcast.com our schedule for the rest of the month. We'll have our January schedule up soon. I think we've mostly programmed it at this point.
Yep.
And we also have a new listener page and a link to our Patreon project you can use to give us a little bit of money if you want to support the thing that we're doing financially. Our hosting and our books and other stuff.
Next week, when you're listening to this, we will be talking Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov with our friend Sophie Brookover. So tune in for that.
All right, everybody, and just have a happy holiday whenever you're listening to this. Have a safe travel. Have a good time with your family. Have some dangerous but consensual and safe sex.
Sure.
If that's what you're into.
Yeah. Or don't. Eat some stuff.
Or don't.
It's cool.
Like,
it's
do
the
whatever
holidays.
You want. Like, it's fine. Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to our dumb podcast. And until we see you next week, everyone, try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.